Not paying attention here to my crib.
Sorry, Your Honor. Took me a while to unpack myself, so thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Robin Wolpert, and I represent the appellant Mario Smith in this matter. All parties agree that Mr. Smith's sentence on count three is unlawful under Johnson because he's not an armed career criminal. Mr. Smith's sentence on count one is also unlawful because he is not a career offender. Mr. Smith's attorney...
Let me stop you on that point. If he had just been sentenced under count one as a career offender, what would be the basis for relief?
It would be ineffective assistance of counsel, Your Honor, because he would not have been able to pursue his guidelines claim on post-conviction if it hadn't been raised on direct appeal. So if he was just sentenced on count one after Johnson overruled Sykes, his argument is the application of the Sykes decision and the career offender guidelines after Johnson overruled Sykes.
But that was not the case at the time of sentence.
No, that's not retroactive.
But if he had been able to raise it on direct appeal, Your Honor, that would have been something that he would have been able to raise on direct appeal.
If he'd been able to raise a challenge to the career offender enhancement?
Well, under Sunbear, if you don't raise your guidelines claims on direct review, ordinarily they're not cognizable on post-conviction, right?
When was the direct appeal completed?
The direct appeal was completed
Johnson, right?
In 2015.
Before Johnson?
A week before Johnson. And, Your Honor...
So Johnson doesn't...
Well, Johnson's
well,
not out. Johnson doesn't invalidate.
All agree he wasn't a career offender, and that's just not right.
Your Honor, he's not a career offender because his counsel was constitutionally ineffective.
That's different than saying all agree. The government doesn't agree to that.
No, I didn't say all agree. I'm sorry. All agree that his ACCA sentence is unconstitutional.
Well, is where you're... If he were to be resentenced... I mean, this issue is about the concurrent sentence doctrine versus the sentencing package, resentencing on a package deal, right?
That's one of the issues, Your Honor.
So you're saying that the district court should not have applied the concurrent sentence doctrine, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what would happen if... So you came out of the gate saying all the parties agree that he's currently no longer ACCA.
Yes.
So if he went back to resentencing... What would happen? Is that what you're saying? He wouldn't be a career offender at that point because of the current guidelines in effect at the time of resentencing?
Your Honor, there are two pathways for Mr. Smith to raise his ineffective assistance of counsel or guidelines claims.
Well, if I can just interrupt, I thought you had two claims. One was whether the district court erred in applying the concurrent sentence doctrine.
Yes.
Okay, that's the one I'm asking
about.
That's
one basis.
Not the IAC. So is that what you're saying? Is if we went back to resentencing and applied the guidelines in effect at the time of resentencing, he wouldn't be a career offender? Is that what you're saying?
Under Section 2255, there's a two-step process for a remedy. So if you're successful under Johnson and the ACCA sentence is unconstitutional, the court vacates and then has four options for a remedy. So our argument is, after Johnson was decided, rendering Mr. Smith's ACCA enhancement unconstitutional, the proper remedy was to vacate that unlawful sentence and then decide what to do. If the court vacated under this court's precedent, then the law of the case would no longer apply and the court would resentence under the current guidelines. So that's one way that Mr. Smith would have been able to be resentenced based on Johnson and also be able to not only argue that the current sentencing guidelines apply, which no longer
What case has agreed with that analysis?
That was, Your Honor, Tidwell and Parker together, as well as the Pepper decision from the United States Supreme Court. But I do want to...
But the concern here is that if the ACCA sentence really had nothing to do with the sentence on count one, then to give the relief you're suggesting is just arguably seems like a backdoor way of applying the career offender guideline amendments retroactively.
Your Honor, may I respond?
I'd like to hear what you say about
sure.
that.
I do want to emphasize that first, we do have a motion to supplement the record, which demonstrates that Mr. Smith's appellate attorney knew about Johnson and the possibility of overruling Sykes, and nevertheless believed that he could raise the guidelines challenge later on post-conviction. So that's one way that the court would be required to examine whether or not that count one sentence was appropriate. Secondly of all, under the sentencing package doctrine, counts one and three were interdependent. And because they were interdependent...
You're familiar with our recent decision in Wright.
Or Eason?
And Eason.
Yeah,
Eason. Yes, Your Honor. But those we submitted a 28-J letter responding to the government. We don't believe that that decision is controlling here. It's distinguishable in many ways.
I think it is, frankly.
But in Mr.
I don't understand why it isn't.
Because in Mr. Smith's case, first of all, we have counts one and three grouped together for purposes of calculation under the guidelines. We have a PSR and the government's position saying concurrent sentences on counts one and three. The court calculated a single total sentence for counts one and three.
The sentence, if the sentence on count one was not influenced by the ACCA aspect of count three, but was the sentence that the court would have imposed on count one regardless.
Respectfully.
And your distinguishing of Eason is not right.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the arguments that I just raised, that they were grouped together for purposes of the calculation, that indicates that the court had a single decision-making calculus for the decision to sentence the identical sentence of 220 months for counts one and three. So the two counts influenced each other and were interdependent.
Okay, you can say that, and theoretically it attaches together, but it's not the real world.
Your Honor, I would point...
It's not the way sentencing does. I mean, grouping has a specific guidelines impact, and here it was to make the count one... independent sentence predominate.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and I would point the court to Henry Davis, the 11th Circuit's decision, where the defendant there got the same concurrent sentences on two counts, and because they were grouped together...
Eason is controlling.
Your Honor, Eason...
You can take this to the court in bank, or my colleagues can disagree, but I mean, I think... They can agree with you, Eason is distinguishable, but I'm not seeing how.
Your Honor, it's distinguishable because, number one, we have a situation here where Mr. Smith had an unconstitutional ACCA sentence, and that is undisputed by all parties. Secondly of all, he had a
gall. That was true in Eason. That was true in Eason.
And here, Mr. Smith has career offender claims that under Gall, it is inappropriate to apply the indeterminate residual clause to him to enhance his sentence under count one.
Beckles is the controlling authority on Beckles, the retroactive effect of Johnson on guidelines issues.
Your Honor, respectfully, that is distinguishable. And in McMillan, this court held that on direct appeal, that application of the career offender enhancement after Beckles and after Johnson overruled Sykes and Chambers and James.
We're not talking direct appeal. Direct appeal is a completely, Beckles is irrelevant on a direct appeal.
It is, Your Honor, and that's why we have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that had counsel raised these issues direct appeal, then they would have been cognizable.
That's a freestanding argument.
It is a freestanding argument.
But it doesn't affect whether the other argument, which is you can get around Beckles by by the sentencing package doctrine.
It is part of the prejudice that Mr. Smith faces with respect to the court's analysis of the concurrent sentence doctrine. It's one of the prejudices he faced because his claim was never addressed. And it is not a Beckles claim. It is a McMillan claim that was successful in this court. And had direct appeal counsel raised it on direct appeal, this court would have remanded for sentencing and Mr. Smith would have been able to raise his guideline claims. So I would point the court to McMillan. Also, Your Honor, you mentioned Eason.
At the rehearing stage.
Yes. So if we were on direct appeal and direct appeal counsel had raised the guidelines claims where Mr. Smith all along had said, Sykes should not apply to me, if that had been one of those claims that had been raised on direct appeal, it was obviously viable during Johnson. Okay.
How about the First Step Act that was enacted last month? Does that impact this case, do you think?
Well, we would ask that the court remand for resentencing, and we have Amendment 782 that would apply, that were the earlier retroactive drug amendments, and we would have to see whether those apply here. But, Your Honor, we have made a motion to supplement the record to add an exhibit to the record, that email exchange with Mr. Smith's appellate attorney, indicating that the attorney chose to raise the guidelines claims later, knowing that...
Why isn't that on the record on appeal?
Your Honor, there was no evidentiary hearing, so that was never put into the record. So at the very least, we believe that there is reason to believe that direct appeal counsel made a strategic decision that was totally wrong under Sunbear. There was no upside to ever waiting for guidelines claims to be raised on post-conviction. And so given that the appellate attorney made that strategic choice, we would at least ask for a remand on the evidentiary record, but I would also at least ask the court to grant the motion, and I do have copies of that email for the court, if the court at this hearing is willing to grant our motion. I see that my time is running down, and I would like to...
The motion doesn't attach the evidence?
We were waiting for the court's ruling before attaching the exhibit, Your Honor.
We can't, you know, that's not the best way to do it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I mean, if you put in what you want to... If you don't put in what you want to supplement the record with, it is so extraordinary to supplement a record on appeal.
Understood, Your Honor, and this is an extraordinary case.
No, without seeing what you're talking about, We can't.
And I have it here today if the court would like to see what I'm talking about.
I don't want it handed up today, but you better supplement your motion.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Genrich?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. David Genrich on behalf of the government. And I'd like to cover, I think, at least three areas this morning. One is why the government believes Eason does control with respect to the concurrent sentence doctrine question. Second is the discussion about Gall, Sykes, and McMillan as sort of freestanding claims. And third is other considerations under the IAC claim. So first, with respect to Eason, the government would argue and submit that it's on all fours with this case, both factually and procedurally. And then with respect to the standard applied in Eason, would be applied in the same way in this case to affirm the district court's exercise of discretion to apply the concurrent sentence doctrine. In Eason, the defendant was convicted on two counts, the identical counts that are at issue in this case.
But in Eason, didn't everyone agree that he would still be a career offender regardless, even upon any kind of resentencing?
That wasn't part of the Eason analysis, Your Honor.
Was that, as a factual matter, part of Eason? That really what they were, the dispute was a collateral...
I apologize. Under the ACCA and Eason, I know the issue was about juvenile adjudications and the actual statutory language in the ACCA that creates a divisibility problem with juvenile adjudications under Minnesota law for use of a dangerous weapon.
Could you adjust that microphone?
Of course, Your Honor. I'm actually not sure if that same analysis would have applied to the career offender, but the takeaway in Eason from the government's perspective is what the court held in Eason is that where the career offender guidelines range at the time of sentencing, at the time he was originally sentenced, is not impacted by the ACCA. where the sentence imposed was not driven by the ACA mandatory minimum, which we know in this case, as we did in Eason, because the 220-month sentence is 40 months higher than the 180 mandatory minimum, and where there's no prejudice from not correcting the alleged error on the ACCA sentence.
So your position is that in Eason, there was no analysis as to whether upon a resentencing on the sentencing package doctrine, whether or not he would remain a career offender. You're saying that that was not addressed by the parties or conceded or not conceded?
What the Eason opinion reveals on that question, Your Honor, is in footnote 2, I believe. And what footnote 2 indicates is that defendant Eason argued that he wanted to be resentenced under the sentencing package doctrine because he felt he might get a lower sentence on the career offender count. It doesn't reveal whether the parties agreed whether he would still be subject to a career offender.
Lower sentence, but not necessarily I would not be a career offender.
Not necessarily. I don't think that's evident from the opinion, Your Honor, and I apologize, I don't know from the record.
What difference would that make to the analysis?
I don't believe it would make a difference. What the court held in Eason is that a district court may apply the concurrent sentence doctrine if the guidelines range at the time of sentencing on the career offender count was unaffected by the ACCA, if the sentence imposed, in this case 220 months, just as in Eason, was not driven by the 180 mandatory minimum, and where there's no showing of prejudice. All of those conditions are satisfied in this case with respect to the concurrent sentence doctrine. Now, to Judge Kelly's question and yours as well, Judge Colleton, if there was a sentencing package analysis, and if a district court was resentencing, and the district court decided which guidelines manual applied, which may be different on remand than it is in the first instance on a 2255, as the court knows from Tidwell and from Brinkman, I believe. If all those are met, certainly there'd have to be an analysis about career offender. But Eason did not at all turn on application of the concurrent sentence doctrine as to whether the career offender guidelines would apply now. It turned on whether correcting that ACCA count demonstrates any infirmity with the career offender count, and it didn't in Eason under the standard set forth.
Any infirmity at the original sentencing,
correct,
would have affected. Yeah,
correct.
What do you think Eason meant in the footnote when it said that the contention misconstrued the sentencing package doctrine?
Well, it cites Wright for that proposition, and in Wright, the district court corrected the ACCA sentence, but left the other sentences untouched. And what I think the footnote means with respect to misconstrues the sentencing package doctrine is that the sentencing package doctrine isn't a trump card for the concurrent sentence doctrine. In other words, if a district court properly exercises its discretion and determines that the concurrent sentence, which is lawful, was imposed and not affected by the ACCA, then a defendant can't say, well, I get to be resentenced on that count anyway under the sentencing package doctrine. That's not how the sentencing package doctrine works. The sentencing package doctrine was adopted by circuit courts, as the court's aware, when the court decides that a district court has imposed a sentence that is a bundle, And the court decides there was error in some respect. And the circuit court, the courts have said that we're not going to figure out whether our decision about the sentencing error would mean that the district court would maintain its prior sentence. Because in a case where sentences are bundled, perhaps their sentencing intent would no longer be satisfied based on our decision. That sentencing package doctrine, which operates primarily on remand to allow a district court to reevaluate its sentence when this court finds error, it is not the controlling analysis here.
Well, does that depend on whether it was quote-unquote bundled in the first place?
It depends.
You said that, I think that's what you were saying.
I think the sentencing package doctrine incorporates principles of bundling and interdependence, but those principles don't inform the concurrent sentence doctrine under its application in Eason and this court's other cases.
That because there was no bundling is my point, though. Is that because in Eason you're saying there was no interdependence between the two counts?
I think that's right.
If there had been, then it might be a different case. Is that the upshot of it?
I think that's right as long as the court is equating interdependence with the ACCA enhancement affecting the career offender's guidelines
that's
range.
That's what I thought you meant by interdependence.
Interdependence isn't a word that's used so much in the concurrent sentencing doctrine, but I agree, Your Honor, it is largely a similar concept as expressed in Eason. But it requires
How do we know in this case that the ACCA sentence didn't affect count one?
Because the guidelines calculations that ended on an offense level of 37, I believe, were driven by the career offender guidelines. The ACCA effect on the guidelines actually would have left the guidelines at, I think, at offense level 34. So the career offender guidelines drove the advisory guidelines range. And the 220-month sentence demonstrates that the 180 mandatory minimum did not drive the district court sentence. That was a factor cited in Eason. And just as in Eason, there's been no showing of prejudice here.
Why does the First Step Act affect the prejudice analysis?
Your Honor, I can't say if...
Are you familiar with it?
I am. We have received word of the First Step Act. My response to the court would be that if the defendant's entitled to relief under the First Step Act, there are motions already being filed and a system in place in our district to handle those.
We have a petition for rehearing in Eason that's pending that says it does affect it. Not necessarily the prejudice aspect, but I think that's where you're going. It affects prejudice, meaning the collateral consequences.
Your Honor, if
the concurrent sentence analysis, right?
I think the answer then to the question is no. I do not believe the First Step Act would affect the Eason analysis insofar as the guidelines for the career offender at the original sentencing were not impacted by the ACCA count. In other words, you could correct the ACCA count and it would have no impact.
That is only dominant if there's no prejudice. I thought the concurrent sentence doctrine does not apply if there are any collateral consequences that's part of sentencing packaging, but if the no impact turns on no impact.
And so
if the First Step Act I don't know if it's an exception to Beckles or an overruling of Beckles or what it is, because it hasn't been fleshed out yet. But it seems to affect what would happen if you remand, on a Johnson remand with a multi-count conviction.
I think perhaps the safest answer for me in representing the government at this point, Your Honor, is to say that the First Act claim, if there is one, has not been raised in this case and has not been briefed and argued, and I wouldn't want to give an inaccurate answer.
But if the First Step Act would affect the sentence on count one, then wouldn't there be a collateral consequence to leaving in effect the sentence on count three?
Only if you assumed that you could not, for example, if you got to the point of remedy and sentencing package doctrine and what do we do, it doesn't necessarily follow that you would have to resentence on count one. In Wright, for example, the court only resentenced the ACCA count and not the count one count. Now, so we're now in the sentencing package doctrine with respect to interdependence on relief. I think it's where the court's suggesting not whether the district court necessarily abuses discretion on concurrent sentencing, but if any relief is required, would you have to resentence on the career offender count based on the First Step Act?
I'm
sorry.
I was on collateral consequences as part of the concurrent sentence analysis, right? There's this collateral consequences which means if you leave in effect the ACCA sentence, even though it was wrong, or even though it would there be a collateral consequence? Well, the collateral consequence would be that any future reduction on count one would be nullified because the count three sentence would stand, right?
I don't believe so. Certainly, if there was a separate basis for relief on resentencing on count one on the First Step Act, that would survive. I think the court's summary of the prejudice prong is correct in that the inquiry is if we leave the ACCA count in place, is the defendant prejudiced? Not if we don't resentence on count one, is the defendant prejudiced? That would create all sorts of backdoors, as the court already suggested. And what the Eason court held was that, for example, supervised release If you leave the ACC count in place, is there prejudice? Eason court decided no with respect to supervised release. The defendant in this case hasn't even argued prejudice as to supervised release. Now, the defendant has argued prejudice in the sense of, I think I could get a lower sentence on count one if I'm resentenced. And that court, that argument was rejected in footnote 2 in Eason. And furthermore, in this case, on the record, the district court said that even if I resentenced, I would give the same 220-month sentence, which the government doesn't necessarily believe this court has to rely on in resolving this case under Eason, but it is a factor that's not present in many of the other cases where, for example, there's a remand after the sentencing package doctrine is applied.
Well, footnote 2 says the argument was that the sentencing package doctrine requires, the original sentence was the type of package that must be reconfigured entirely once his ACCA sentence is vacated. Now, since the sentencing package doctrine is judicially created to shape how a discretionary decision is made, that argument was misunderstood, both the origins and the nature of the sentencing package doctrine. But if rejecting that doesn't mean that if there was a serious reason to think that this count one sentence would be affected.
Your Honor, as the author of
your argument is, well, if it isn't affected by the Johnson error, then it's not fair game. I don't know that Eason goes that far.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. Eason applies the concurrent sentence doctrine. Had the ACCA designation affected the career offender guideline, even though it's only the ACCA count that's unconstitutional in its application of the sentence, clearly Eason contemplated a remand for resentencing. Although in Eason, there's no indication whether the district court had stated it would have imposed the same sentence, which again is a factor here that's not present even in Eason. But
the district court, I mean, what we're reviewing is the district court's decision that I'm just applying the concurrent sentence doctrine because the 220 months stays the same. And I'm not sure that, I think the issue is whether that was an adequate exercise of discretion, that that these two doctrines gave the court in this strange world.
I, for the reasons stated in the government's brief and this morning, I do believe it was an appropriate exercise. If I could just in my remaining time talk a bit about the Gall-Sykes-McMillan argument.
Could I ask a question about, and I think it'll be a quick question about the ineffective assistance of counsel. We've certainly said that counsel doesn't have to predict, doesn't need a crystal ball be required to have one to anticipate a change in the law. If I have the timing right here, however, the mandate hadn't issued by the time Johnson did come down. Has that changed the analysis? Am I right that this decision, the appellate court decision for Mr. Smith came down maybe the 19th, and then the 26th, Johnson came down? There would have been time for a petition for a rehearing by the panel. Does that affect the analysis?
Well, it's certainly not an argument made here, Your Honor, first, in terms of where we stand in the briefing and the claims made. The claim made here is that the appellate counsel should have noticed Johnson in its direct appeal. And I don't believe what the court has just recited does affect that claim. Was the counsel ineffective for not seeking a petition for rehearing? I don't think it's any different than a lot of the Batson cases. In some instances, Batson had been handed down. And the court's doctrine with respect to anticipating changes in the law was firmly applied. And it's been applied in a variety of circumstances since Batson, in instances where counsel were clearly aware that a change in the law was possible. I don't think the mandate is controlling, and particularly under the arguments made in this case, Your Honor. Could I ask to leave the court for 1 minute on the McMillan or no? Okay.
It's in the brief, and I don't understand how Gall applies to this at all. So I
very well, Your Honor. Thank you.
Your time for rebuttal? Oh, yep, there it is.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. First, I do want to point out that in our brief, we did argue that appellate counsel should have moved to stay the mandate, that there was plenty of time to do that. So that is actually an argument that we raised. Going back to Eason and the applicability.
Reply brief? Was it raised in the
district? It is in the reply brief for sure.
Which is untimely, of course, by myriad of our decisions. We don't consider things first raised in reply brief.
I was just trying to remember where we also, I believe it was raised
in the district court?
Yes, that there were multiple stages during the direct appeal process where counsel could have asked either through a 28J letter or through a motion to stay the proceedings or for motion for supplemental briefing that counsel could have raised the impact of Johnson on the pending appeal. With respect to
a case where the failure to ask for rehearing was the basis for appellate counsel,
I have not found such a case, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to Eason and the applicability of Eason, I would just distinguish it again on additional grounds to those in our letter, which is that this court or the district court could not have reimposed the sentence that was originally imposed on Mr. Smith. Not only did it exceed the statutory maximum, but it also was unconstitutional. So under 2255, the first step would have been to vacate the sentence and then correct or resentence. And so given the vacation.
Now, you're talking about sentencing as opposed to determining range. I mean, Booker is now 13 years old. The court obviously could have imposed the same sentence by reason of variance.
I would point.
It might or might not be substantively unreasonable, but the court, wasn't there a 200 month variance to downward to get to 220?
Yes, Your Honor. But I would point the court to Harlow and Gray, where I think those decisions are instructive on this very question of whether the court could have imposed the same sentence given the constitutional and statutory claims raised.
Cases or
are those?
Well, the vindictive principle.
No, I don't think so. No.
All right.
I would also point the court to Evans, which preceded Eason, where the court clearly applied the sentencing package doctrine and sent a case back for resentencing because the counts were grouped together and the cases cited in our brief regarding.
Your brief and your time's up, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been effectively briefed and argued, and we'll take it under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.